So I should begin this evening with some practical announcements to inform everybody that the British government today announced some new regulations that will come into force tomorrow. If anyone in your household shows symptoms of fever or coughing, then the whole household has to self-isolate for 2 weeks. And they also encourage, an increase of, self-isolation or refraining from gathering together. To refrain from increasing social contact. So that would be any kind of travel, social contact, also to avoid being in confined spaces, gathering in groups, large or small. So this affects places like clubs, restaurants, cinemas, etc., monasteries. People are encouraged to be working from home wherever possible. These regulations, stipulations will be in place for several weeks, maybe up to 2 or 3 months, depending on how things proceed. We'll have a discussion amongst our little coronavirus subcommittee here for the monastery, amongst the community here, and to decide how we want to how we need to change our routine. Gatherings like this will probably have to terminate for the foreseeable future, but at least we're legal for this evening. Things will need to change from tomorrow, so we'll have a get together in the morning to discuss what changes might need to be made, and then we'll make a more thorough announcement around the mealtime tomorrow. It goes without saying that these are extraordinary times. The kind of restrictions that are being put in place by the UK government, also around the world, through Europe, in Asia, the Americas, there's a huge number of restrictions being put in place. So, say in Ireland, all the pubs have been closed. In France, the cafes, restaurants, cinemas, theatres are closed. In Austria, I think they don't allow gatherings of more than 5 people together. Borders are closed in many, many countries, airports, and people are encouraged to isolate or required to isolate themselves in their own homes. So these are very extraordinary measures, unprecedented in our times. And so the level of alarm, concern, anxiety around this country and around the world is very, very high. Numbers of people infected, over 100,000 people have been infected by the virus. Quite a few thousand have passed away already. These are issues of great concern. They impact everybody's lives. But I feel in terms of our lives, then it's not just a matter of what we do on a practical level to look after our own health and the health of those whom we live with or those who come to visit and spend time here. But it's also important not to forget why we're here in the first place. Why do we live at Amaravati? Why do we bring ourselves to be in a place and focus our attention on practicing the Buddha's path, reflecting on the Buddha's teachings, and not neglect or to forget those aspects of our lives. As I was suggesting during the morning reflection in the guided meditation earlier today, one of the essential things I would suggest to consider is that, in a way, nothing really has changed. The presence of this illness and the pandemic nature of it spreading around the world, being extremely communicable, and the disruption, the changes to people's lives. This is the kind of thing that the Buddha's teaching really prepares us for. It's a good object lesson in uncertainty and the fragile nature of our lives, our health, our well-being, and our very lifespan. So I feel that it's important in the most sort of profound sense to see that nothing has gone wrong. This is, in a way, situation normal, that the fragile nature of life has always been this way. We as a human society perhaps have become, particularly in the sort of comfortable Western society that we live in here, we have become, oblivious, unaware of that fragile nature. We become complacent. We take things for granted. We assume that things are predictable, that we're able to live a comfortable life. There'll be medical resources when we need them. We'll be able to go the places that we like to go, do the things we like to do, and spend the time with the people that we like, and that life is so predictable and can carry on and in the way that we would assume it's structured to be, and we'll be able to live happily ever after with the people that that we like, with our families and our community. And so that kind of fairy tale imagination, the presence of this kind of disease going rampant around the world, it disrupts that. It makes it very clear that those kind of assumptions are seeing things in a very shallow way, not seeing the whole picture. And the Buddha's teachings point directly at this, uncertain and fragile nature of our lives. The teaching I like to quote most often on this, where the Buddha addresses an assembly and asks the question, how long is a human lifespan? And the first person says, 70 years we can expect to live, 70 years. And the Buddha said, you don't understand my teaching. Then 60, 50, 40, 30, you don't understand my teaching. 20, 10 years, 5 years, you don't understand my teaching. We can't expect to live more than 1 year. That's all we can expect to live. You don't understand my teaching. And then so on down, 6 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month. And each of those suggestions, the Buddha says, you don't understand my teaching. And then, say, half a month, 1 week, one quarter of the moon, a single day and a single night. And again, the Buddha says, you don't understand my teaching. Then it reduces all the way down to, the time it takes to milk a cow, 20 minutes. The time it takes to eat a meal. And the Buddha says, you don't understand my teaching. Finally, one person says, we can only expect to live for the time it takes to go from the beginning to the end of an in-breath or the beginning to the end of an out-breath. And the Buddha said, you understand my teaching. So that, if you time it, is about 3 or 4 seconds, in my estimation. That's all we can reasonably look forward to. So to our egos and to our habitual perceptions, that's shocking and frightening. We can only look forward to living another 3 or 4 seconds. Is the Buddha trying to scare us? Is he being depressive or threatening? But no, he's being realistic. That's how nature works. That if we have an aneurysm, if a blood vessel bursts in our brain, then you have that kind of amount of time when everything starts to go black, and then whoop, out you go. And life can come to an end that quickly, just through natural circumstances, not through being hit by a rock or falling off a cliff, but just through the body giving out through natural circumstances. You have that amount of time to play with. That's all we can be sure of. The rest is extra. So that the reason why the Buddha points that out is encouraging us to be realistic and encouraging us not to be complacent, not to take things for granted, and particularly to bring attention to the present reality, the present experience, and to focus on what the mind is doing. In what way does the mind relate to the present experience? So I feel that right now we have this opportunity, very, very clear opportunity, to develop this perception of impermanence, what is called the anicca sanya, and to open the heart to that fragile nature of our existence, and the existence of all people, all things. And so that turning towards that quality, really acknowledging, accepting that's not just an unfortunate mistake, but this is the reality of how it is and how it always has been, then that enables the heart to really be in tune with that reality. There's a fundamental realism in that, and in that realism there's a relaxation, there's an ease. When we take things for granted, we expect we're going to live so many decades, or we're going to have a comfortable life, we're going to live happily ever after with the people that we like, then we are, say, making foolish assumptions about life. And at times like this, those are revealed. We've been, in a sense, looking for certainty and assuming there's certainty where it can't really be found. We've been looking for something dependent. We've been depending on something that is not dependable. And so that if we have not questioned that or not explored that, not examined that, then when it's revealed, no, you can't depend on it. You can't be sure of your own health. You can't be sure there's going to be medical supplies. You can't be sure there's going to be hospital beds available. You can't be sure there's going to be enough doctors and nurses and such like. It's not a sure thing. Then we're shocked. We feel something's gone wrong. We feel it shouldn't be this way, or this is unfair. Or how can this happen? And those foolish dependencies are revealed to us. And this is not being hard-hearted or malicious, but just helping us to see where those dependencies have formed, those expectations have formed, and what the mind has, say, become accustomed to, or it has taken for granted. So even though we don't choose for a disease like this to spread around the world and to cause such damage and disruption to everybody's lives, I feel it's also a very good opportunity to really bring these truths home, to bring it to heart, to see, well, what have you taken refuge in? What have we taken as being reliable, as dependable? What have we given value to in our lives? What are the life goals that we've created for ourselves as an individual or as a society? What are those goals? What are the things that we've come to rely on? What do we assume to be true and real and good? And are those dependable? Are they really good? Are they true? Are they real? Are they anything substantial? Or was that substantiality, that those goals, were they more superficial or fragile or not dependable, not of true value? Another of the teachings that I like to refer to in this respect is where this old disciple of the Buddha, Nakulapita, comes to him. Nakulamata, this elderly couple, they were very devoted, dedicated disciples of the Buddha, and they had a particularly close connection with him. They'd apparently been his parents in hundreds of previous lifetimes, so he had a close association with them. I think they lived at a place called Sumsumaragira, if I remember correctly, in the Besakala Grove. They would come and ask the Buddha questions and visit him quite often. So one time Nakulapita came to the Buddha, and he's about 100 years old at this time, and he said, "I'm really aged, decrepit. You know, the years have accumulated. They are a burden to me. I'm 100 years old. My body is weak and wrinkled, and my health is not good. My strength is not good. My eyes and ears are wearing out. What advice can you give, Venerable Sir, to someone in a condition like mine, being so aged, so decrepit, so worn down by the decades of living?" And the Buddha's response is to Nakulapita. He said, "It's far better to be afflicted in body and not afflicted in mind than it is to be afflicted in mind and not afflicted in the body." So he's essentially saying having a healthy body but an unhealthy mind is a disadvantage, is to be avoided, to be, say, abandoned, and to be something that is not to be sustained or cherished. But rather, if as long as the mind is healthy, as long as the mind has a good attitude, a skillful attitude, as long as the mind is in a healthy state, then whether or not the body is sick and aged is secondary to that. So he then goes on to explain, so how is one afflicted in body but not afflicted in mind? And then he repeats to Nakulapita the whole of the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. He chanted that yesterday morning. We chant very regularly, and this teaching about not self, and particularly using the analysis of reflecting on anicca, change, uncertainty, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and anatta, not self, in relationship to body and mind. So exploring the habits of dependency and attachment, looking for certainty, nicca, happiness, sukha, and self, atta, in the body and mind, in the five khandhas, in this physical form, and then feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. And that's what he does. The Buddha walks Nakulapita through that, and so this is how, you know, even with a decrepit body, being so old and having say poor eyes, poor ears, you can still, in terms of the attitude of mind, can be independent of those limitations, those discomforts and difficulties, the experience of aches and pains and fading senses, that still the attitude towards that can be skillful, and to see that the body and the mind, the nama and the rupa, these factors, these five khandhas, can be recognized as being intrinsically anicca, uncertain, in a state of change, transformation, dukkha, unsatisfactory, unable to be, productive of happiness, contentment in a continual or sustainable way, and anatta, they're not self, they're not who and what we are. And so that's what how the Buddha describes being having well-being in mind, or being healthy in mind, and saying how that's far more important, far more significant and helpful in the long run than having, say, a healthy body and a comfort and fully functioning senses, but having a mind that's filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, the mind that is attached to self-view and greed, hatred, delusion, and the unskillful qualities. So in this respect, I feel that as practitioners of Buddha Dhamma, people committing ourselves to the Buddha's path, either people living here as monastics, the nuns and monks, people who've made a longer-term commitment, the people in training, anagarikars, samaniras, lay people who are resident here, committed practitioners, or people who are staying here for a shorter time, or just visiting for the evening. It's for all of us, these are significant things to bring to mind, and it helps us to consider what are our life goals? What do we want in life? What are we expecting? What are we looking forward to? How much do we create that dependency, consciously or unconsciously, on a healthy body, on a nice place to live, having your good friends around you, looking for a spiritual community, or looking for a family, assuming that they're all going to be around. A society that's cohesive, a health system that is reliable, supportive, and accessible, a shelter to live in, a comfortable home that keeps the rain out, keeps the cold out in the winter, and the heat out in the summer, keeps the rain off, and so on and so forth. How much do we take refuge in that? How much are our life goals just trying to have a comfortable, looking for a comfortable retirement, make sure we're going to be looked after, have a good insurance plan or a good retirement plan, having a dependable support system in place so that you won't be lonely and decrepit and old and in pain and sick and abandoned. There's quite reasonable concerns. In this country and in many countries in the West in particular, there's a lot of provision for that the society goes to great lengths to make sure that people don't suffer from hunger and isolation. People are well looked after into their old age and decrepitude. But I feel that if all we can look forward to in life is a comfortable retirement, as monastics, then we don't have families and children in the same kind of way as regular people in society. But still, if what we're looking forward to is a comfortable place to stay, and people to look after us, and a good supply of food and shelter and medicine and clothing, then we've made our life very limited. The potential of our human existence has been made extremely narrow, very, very poor, very unfulfilled, I would suggest. And just like the advice that the Buddha gave to Nakulapita, that to be afflicted in body but not afflicted in mind is much, much better, much more important than being afflicted in mind and not afflicted in the body. So I feel it's a thing within our society that it's a very secular, materialistic society, and so for most people, that there isn't a kind of spiritual goal that is put forward. Talking about with some people the other day, we don't. How many people say with their lives that what they are looking forward to is sainthood? How many people have sainthood as their life goal? How many people say they're looking forward to enlightenment before they pass away? Within a few spiritual groups, we might have that as our aspiration, but in society, that sense of spiritual development and the spiritual potential that we have as human beings is really not talked about. There isn't really a language for it. So I feel this is also one of the things that Amaravati and Buddha Dhamma can help to present to society as a whole. And not just because of the circumstances of this epidemic, but in general, that sense of spiritual potential and having a life goal of enlightenment, or at least stream entry, rather than a comfortable retirement home and a good insurance plan, is far more liberating, is far more helpful, and can bring far more genuine happiness and fulfillment than just a material comfort and the sense of staving off the feelings of loneliness and hunger and desperation at the end of your life. If we have used our life, our mind, our human energy, and this spiritual potential, if we have, say, made that a focus of attention, then the end of our lives as we get older, whenever that the ending of the life comes, whether there is physical comfort and a good food supply and a roof over our head, and good friends, companions, family nearby, although it isn't, then we are fine. There's an ease, a contentment, whether or not there's physical comfort and material support, whether that's there or whether it's not. The heart is fine. Just again, as the Buddha laid it out for Nakulapita, I think we can really take that to heart, that this is a far more helpful in terms of a life plan and a real insurance policy. If you really want to be insured, then realize stream entry. If you want to have to live happily ever after, you know, don't worry about the National Health Service or the social services so much as your own heart, your own mind. That's what really brings the happily ever after ideal to fulfillment is developing the potential that we have, using the capacity, the time, the energy, the spiritual resources, mental resources that we have, using them to their full capacity. In this respect, I think it's useful to reflect on what the Buddha laid out as the factors that support stream entry. Also, I think these are very good human qualities to be dealing with the current epidemic and the social distress, the difficulties and anxieties, the intensity of emotions in the people around us or within ourselves. And when you talk about the factors of stream entry, it can sound a bit technical or remote, but it's also useful stuff to have to deal with the community that we're in, the society that we're in, and the difficulties of the challenges of the particular current situation. So the first of the four factors of stream entry is sapurisa sangseva, which means association with good people, drawing close to good people. So sapurisa, sa means good, purisa is a person, sangseva is association with, so drawing close to good people. So that to the extent that we have any choice, sitting at appropriate distances from each other, be discerning about who you spend your time with. If there's a choice between being with someone who is peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, and someone who is reactive, self-centered, who is demanding, greedy, or aggressive, say, then choose the peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Drawing close to good people, drawing close to people that encourage wisdom, that encourage compassion, that encourage kindness, that encourage equanimity, and these skillful qualities of the heart, that will help you to similarly strengthen those qualities within yourself. If you draw close to people and spend time with people who are anxious, fearful, agitated, aggressive, blaming, complaining, then it will strengthen those qualities within you. You get drawn into the conversation of that kind, you get drawn into the mindset of that kind. The Buddha was incredibly practical and observant. He realized, we are affected by the people that we spend time with. We're affected by the places where we choose to go. We are affected by the environment around us. So, if we want to cultivate wholesome qualities, if we want to cultivate that which is liberating and noble, then to the extent that one has a choice, draw close to people who embody those wholesome qualities, to be strengthening that within yourself. And also when we are spending time with each other, just within your own mind, this to be a source of that sapurisa, those sapurisa qualities for the people that you are with. So that if you find yourself getting anxious or agitated or aggressive and blaming, complaining, then to be discerning. Say, well, do I need to fill somebody else's mind with my own anxieties? Or do I need to express my, agitated opinions? Do I need to put my aggressive blaming tendencies out into the world? Do I need to give that energy and strength? Do I need to fill somebody else's ears with my own, reactive patterns? And see that we have a choice, and to choose to not be having that effect on other people, and to be, thoughtful, discerning about the kind of contact that we have. Then sadhamma savana is the second one, listening to the good dhamma. So, particularly in times like this that are sort of distressing and difficult, then what kind of dhamma do you fill the mind with? What kind of information do you bring into your field of experience? What do you choose to pay attention to? And so that sadhamma, the good dhamma, or the true dhamma, that means making choices to listen, to be guided by that which is genuinely in tune with nature, in tune with reality. Again, not just things that are compelling or exciting, or someone is asserting a particular point of view, or promising, "Oh, if this is the way to cure coronavirus, and if you do this, you've got to do this. You can't do that. You shouldn't do this." To be discerning, okay, where's this information coming from? Where's this? What's the source of this? Is this reliable? Is it useful for me to be putting my attention onto this? Is this really helpful? Is this liberating, or is this just more noise? Or is this just a distraction? Am I just listening to this or reading this or putting my mind onto this just to get away from these anxious feelings or these agitated feelings, or because of being angry because of the government doing this, or the doctors doing that, or the monastery doing something that I don't like, or I feel we should do it this way rather than that way, to say, okay, sadhamma savana, is this a good dhamma? Is this a collection of words or ideas, principles that lead to freedom from complication? Do they lead to peacefulness? Do they lead to ease and clarity? Or do they lead to more confusion, more tension, more conflict? What's the result of listening to these words, bringing attention to these words? So sadhamma savana is the second of the four factors supportive of stream entry. Then the third one is yoniso manasikara, wise reflection, skillful attention. So that's looking at our body, looking at our mind, our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, looking at the situation that we're in, looking at the community that we're a part of, looking at the society. Wise reflection. Okay, what's going on here? How does this work? What is a skillful choice to make with respect to this? What can be said that will be helpful? What can be done that will be helpful? Is there something to be done? Is there nothing to be done? So wise reflection, using the mind's ability to recognize how things work, the patterns in which nature operates, and to be guided by that, to see how things relate with each other, cause and effect, how things interact, What's a useful way of handling this conversation or this work I have to do or the situation with my family or with the society? A wise reflection then is that the power of the mind to look, to explore, to investigate, and to see how things function, how things relate with each other. And that's an extraordinary ability. So it's not just a matter of thinking and a memory, but a sense of freedom from presumptions, not just following the mind's biases or habits of thinking. It's not just having a clever mind, but it's also broadening the attitude to set aside your own preferences, your own habits of thinking, your own emotional reactions of like and dislike, approval and disapproval, to clearly look at the whole picture in the best and most substantial way possible. Wise reflection, investigation. And sometimes when that quality of wise reflection is applied, then there's a looking at some situation, one of our mind states or a feeling or a situation around us, and we go, what's the best thing to do here? And what arises is, I don't have a clue. Like, what's going on? This particular feeling in our heart, or particularly in a particular mental image or a thought, where does that come from? What's that about? And again, what might arise is, I don't have a clue. I have no idea what that's about. I don't know where that comes from. And so wise reflection is not always having an answer for everything or figuring everything out, but also to recognize sometimes you don't know what's going on. You don't know why you feel excited or agitated or afraid or irritated. It's not clear where it comes from. So I would say part of wise reflection is letting the mysterious be mysterious. You don't have to fill up the unknown with an opinion or an interpretation, an explanation, but say, well, I don't know what that's about, but here it is. Yeah. Or with a situation, someone might be very agitated or upset and be coming to ask you for help or for advice. And wise reflection might also in that situation like that say, well, I'd love to be able to help this person, but I haven't got a clue what to say in order to be of real benefit. I don't know where they're coming from. I don't have an answer for the question that they're asking. So that quality of wise reflection is also being ready to say, I don't know, or I can't help, or I don't know what this is about, as well as the times where wise reflection does bring a clear answer or a clear interpretation, brings a recognition of how things are working together. And the fourth of the four factors supportive of stream entry is Dhamma Anu Dhamma Patipada, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And there's different ways of interpreting this, but I feel that it's particularly pointing to what we think of as practicing Dhamma, so keeping the precepts, practicing meditation, practicing right speech, right action, right livelihood, doing the Dhamma things, as it were, but not just performing acts that are labeled doing Dhamma practice, like Sila, Samadhi, and Panya, the precepts and meditation practices, or even developing insight using the reflections on anicca, dukkha, anatta, not just following those Dhamma patterns or things that are labeled Dhamma out of an attitude fueled by desire or fueled by fear or fueled by self-view, fueled by aversion or just habit, but practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma means making effort to develop, to use the sila, to effort to develop concentration, the efforts to develop wisdom, to speak and act skillfully, free from self-view, free from conceit, free from the influences of greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's not easy to do, but just as we can put on our robes or shave our head or follow the routine and, or recite Buddhang Saranang Gacchami or Panatipata Viramani, we can do the Dhamma actions, we can follow the Dhamma forms, we can do that out of habit, we can do it because, well, I'm a Buddhist monk, so this is what I wear, or these are the words that we chant, that's the custom, the form. But as Lumpu Cha would say, that it's like a fruit, like a mango or a banana. If you only are following the external form, it's just like the skin of the mango or the skin of the banana. The reason why these fruits are valuable or important is the actual flesh of the fruit that can be eaten, that can nourish us. The skin is there to help sort of protect it or contain it. If you eat mango skins or banana skins, then it gives you really bad indigestion. They don't taste good either. So just as with practicing Dhamma that's not in accordance with Dhamma, we can be following the forms of sort of doing Dhamma things like reciting the precepts or even, keeping the precepts of wearing the robes and following the routine and sort of doing the meditation forms. But if that's driven by I'm doing this because I should do this, or it's expected of me, or if I do this then I'm going to be happy in the future, if I follow this formula then I'll realize stream entry, I'm an unenlightened person now, and if I do this then I'm going to get enlightened in the future, there'll be an enlightened me rather than an unenlightened me, and that's highly desirable. That's what I really want, is to have an enlightened me. And that the degree that is embedded in the attitude that I'm doing this to get something for me, or I'm doing this because the Ajahn's expected of me, or I'm doing this because I've made a commitment to be a good Buddhist, and this is what good Buddhists do, that I would say that it's very easy for those, if our practice, if our efforts, if our actions and speech are driven, motivated by those elements of self-centeredness or fear or habit or obligation, just say doing it because it's customary or you're just used to it, then it can't lead towards genuine liberation. It's only if our actions, our speech, our efforts are in tune with Dhamma, so essentially free from conceit, from mana, free from self-view, but are instead guided by mindfulness and wisdom, motivated by mindfulness and wisdom, then those efforts, action and speech and inner and outer activity, then that will genuinely lead to liberation. I feel that we are skillful in relationship to this current epidemic, and we'll fit in with the various stipulations by the government and the health services and so on. But I feel that if there is the right attitude, if we cultivate a skillful attitude, then rather than thinking of this this epidemic as something that disrupts our lives or is an obstruction to the practice or is something that's intrinsically bad and awful in every respect, then I would say that's a foolish or an unfortunate attitude to have. But rather, if we are skillful, obviously we're not relishing or delighting in the fact that there's a lot of illness and difficulty and disruption around. But if the attitude is skillful, and that we use the opportunity of, say, the changes to our routine, the recognition of the fragility of our lives and the lives of all those around us, if we use these in a skillful way, then and we take the situation to consciously develop these spiritual qualities of Developing the attributes of a sapurisa to be more thoughtful about what we attend to, what we listen to, the kind of words that we put into the world, the words that we attend to cultivate wise reflection and to cultivate the practice of Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, then even though it's a challenging circumstance or it's disruptive to our normal routines, then the situation itself can be turned to great benefit, can be turned to great advantage. And it's a strange thing, but often in human society, it's the times of greatest difficulty and distress, even being in a war, that brings out the most powerful, positive human qualities. Brings the aspects of unselfishness, of generosity, of compassion, really to the fore. Often listening to the stories that my mother, my father talked about going through the Second World War in the British Army. They're in different places. They didn't meet until after the war was over. But particularly, my mother was in the Blitz. She was an army driver in the Blitz in London, and then after D-Day, she was over in France, Germany. Shortly after D-Day and with the army progressing into the continent, even though it's a war and incredible distress and massive quantities of unskillful behavior, death being caused all around, on a day-to-day human level, the extraordinary acts of kindness and generosity and compassion between people was really striking, and just the paramita that are called forth, having to deal with that kind of difficulty, dealing with the fragile nature of human life. You know, you're sitting down with someone at supper, you don't know if either of you are going to be alive the next morning. You know that life and death are so close. And because of that, the qualities of kindness, of generosity, of compassion, unselfishness were really strengthened and really fortified, really brought to the fore. And so that not just my parents, but oftentimes people recognize, oh, you know, we were so much better. We treated each other so much better when there was a war on, and we become selfish and greedy and lazy when there isn't. So I feel also, and again, not wishing the epidemic to continue or to increase or to cause more havoc, but I feel that when there are challenging times like this, where there are our usual values are shaken up, where there we're not allowed, the situation doesn't allow us to be so complacent, that this too can be a situation where our noblest and most valuable spiritual qualities are really brought to the fore, and particularly the qualities of compassion, of people looking out for each other, people looking to ways to help each other, qualities of equanimity, being ready to be calm and steady in the midst of activity and agitation, turbulence, to be unselfish, to share the things that you have, and to be looking out for each other. These are it's an extraordinary opportunity for those very wholesome, skillful qualities to be developed. I was noticing in a news report a couple who have a little shop. I think it was up in Lothian in Scotland, and they were giving away some people were buying up gallons and gallons of hand sanitizer to sell it at high prices. This husband and wife little shop, they were actually giving it away, giving away toilet paper and hand sanitizer to free for the all of the older people in their area in particular. And I thought, well, good for them. You know, they're small shopkeepers, but they need to make a living like anybody else. But they're ready to give away these essential supplies. And how noble, how beautiful, rising up to a stressful situation with acts of kindness and thoughtfulness and the readiness to share what they have to be of benefit to the people around them, to say, recognize there is a kind of an importance beyond their own personal gain, their own personal benefit or convenience. So I don't know how long it'll be before we can gather together again for this kind of a observance day ceremony. We'll, as I said, the little coronavirus committee that we have formed to help take care of the practical arrangements for Amravati will meet tomorrow morning and go through what the new requirements are and how we might adjust things, but probably have a more clearly worked out game plan and let people know at the meal time tomorrow. But I would suggest during this evening, as the meditation continues, I think we'll carry on as we usually do. Have the observance up until midnight. People can carry on the meditation and then close the evening with a short period of chanting right at midnight. But during this time, continuing the sitting, walking, meditation, just to use the opportunity to see, well, what is the mind making of this? Yeah, how much is the mind going towards fear or aversion, going towards imagining the future, to focus upon personal concerns or irritations and opinions. We should do this, we shouldn't do that. This is right, that's wrong. I want this, I don't want that. What's going to happen? How is it going to work? What's going to... You know, all of those projections and the emotional surges that so easily arise, and to use the practice to know that, to explore that, to wisely reflect upon that. To use those kind of reactive patterns to recognize, well, what am I looking at? What am I taking refuge in? Am I taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, or am I taking refuge in predictability, in physical health? Am I taking refuge in the idea of certainty, of comfort, of physical security? What's the mind taking refuge in? And to look at that, to explore that, to see how the more that the mind tries to take refuge in the five khandhas, the more it's creating the causes for disappointment and dukkha. The more that the mind takes refuge in awareness, in reality, and in goodness, in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, look at the results of that. So that this is a really excellent, a prime opportunity to see where the mind really takes refuge. And to train it to take refuge in Dhamma, in the reality of the way things are, in the Buddha, the quality of wakeful awareness, Sangha, the quality of choosing goodness, choosing the wholesome, and then see what the results of that shift of focus is. The mind has influences of the guided by instinct, protection for the body, the way that we fit into society, the way that we exist within our family, the human family or our immediate family or our community. There are powerful instinctual forces at work in the mind, with food, shelter, safety, and so on and so forth. look at those instincts. Look at how the mind tries to take refuge in shelter, in clothing, in food, in medicine, in predictability, caring and protective society. To look at those habits, looking for security in that which is not secure, looking for reliability in that which is not reliable. Look at that. To look at those tendencies and say, don't be afraid to turn towards that and say, well, is that reliable? Is that dependable? The mind is trying to take refuge in sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thinking. It's trying to take refuge in material form, in feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. These are not dependable. They're not reliable. They're not stable. So if you try to take refuge in that which is not a refuge, look what happens. You try to depend on that which is not dependable, look what happens. So that that investigation then supports the change of view, the change of lineage, that it constitutes stream entry, no longer identifying with the body, the mind, the personality, but rather letting the mind know its own nature as Dhamma. The mind is Dhamma. It's not a person. It's not a thing. The mind is Dhamma, not a person. And that when that change of lineage, that change of view is established, then that quality of security, of stability, of reliability can be known directly. That's why the three refuges are called refuges. They are a safe place. The mind stops looking for security where it can't be found. It looks instead for security in what is really reliable, what is secure, what is dependable, which is the Dhamma itself. And so these words are said to encourage that, but it's most important that each of us works to genuinely establish that realization, and to see that the happily ever after dream is only or aspiration is only realizable through that inner transformation. If you really want to live happily ever after, then the realization of Dhamma is the way that aspiration can be fulfilled, I would suggest. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.